Welcome to Praxis, a podcast where we explore how to practice and embody the way of Jesus in our everyday lives. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen. So we're in a series right now focused on cultivating a healthy church culture. We say that every church has a culture, whether they realize it or not. Some church cultures are reasonably healthy, while others are not so healthy. And of course, no church is perfect, but part of the work that every church needs to engage is intentionally working to close whatever gap exists between being healthy and where they currently are. So in this series, that's what we're doing. We're seeking to close the gap. And this involves not only talking about the marks of an unhealthy church culture, but also casting vision for how we as the church can embody a way of life together that, while it may not be perfect, is oriented towards goodness and kindness and love. And today we want to talk about the fourth toxin in the soil of unhealthy churches, and that's dogmatism. So let's get into it.
Well, welcome everybody. My name is Josiah.
And I'm Mac.
And I'm Katie.
So to get us started today, I have a question for us, a question that I've been reflecting on in my own life. And it does have something to do with today's episode. But the question is this: what is a strong opinion you have about something that is slightly uninformed? Like, what's a strong, you feel strong about something, yet it's probably not super informed? Like, I'll start, just so this makes sense. I feel very strongly about aesthetics and interior design. When I walk into a room, I have strong feelings about how it feels and that it should feel better. But I am not educated or have taken any sort of formal training on interior design, so I don't necessarily know how to name why something can feel off when I walk into the room, but I still feel very strongly about it, if it's good or bad. So that'd be an example of, like, I have a strong yet slightly uninformed opinion about interior design.
This explains everything about your office.
Why is that?
Oh, it's just very well sort of arranged. The lighting seems very important to you. You've got very, like, important. Those lamps in the corner instead of the overhead lights. You've got the shelves, like, perfectly spaced with decor. And like, now it makes sense. I think I have strong feelings about your feelings about the environment.
My environment's very important.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
Is there a difference between opinion and preference in your mind?
I think we could, for the sake of this discussion, we can say that would be allowed.
Okay, because I'm thinking of some preferences, but I'm like, well, I don't.
Yeah, I don't share uninformed opinions.
I mean, I'm just informed about everything.
All my opinions are extremely informed.
I can think of kind of a preference thing that, okay, sometimes when we're driving in the car, Alex will have talk radio on, but it's down, it's like the volume is down so that you can't really make out what they're saying, but he just enjoys it as background noise. And I can't stand it. I'm like, either turn it up so we can hear it, or let's just, like, turn it off. So I don't know. I guess I don't have any reason to hold that opinion, but there you go.
You know, I think one area for me, now that I reflect on it, is, and maybe this is, like, I have an opinion on it or can detect it, but don't have, like, the skill set to do it myself, would be when it comes to music and vocals, for instance. Like, I can usually pinpoint when it's not sounding the way it should, and it drives me nuts. But I'm not, like, a vocalist. I'm not good at singing at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that'd be like, I have a really strong reaction when music is not working, but it's not like I could get up there and be like, oh, here's how to do it the way you could, Josiah.
Mm. Yeah, if you were hearing something on Sunday, you would know if something's off.
Yes,
but
for
wouldn't
sure.
necessarily know how to correct it.
Yeah, it's not like I can go up to the drummer and be like, no, dude, this is how it goes.
That's a good one.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Josiah, but in general, I stay in my lane. All my opinions are very informed.
Yeah. I'm sure Josie would agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I love that you asked that question, Josiah, because I feel like it captures your personality very well. Wow. You do have strong opinions. I'm not saying they're uninformed, but we all appreciate that about you.
Yeah. And I've had to learn over the years in my social circles that I to not attach too much to those opinions, just to share them. And I'm probably a little dramatic about how I share them, and be willing to sort of be shot down in the moment, be like, yeah, I know it's stupid, but yeah, I don't know. I've enjoyed being able to just express them. And sometimes people agree, and other times I just get laughed at, like Cameron on our church staff. I have come to find he's a very, very dear friend, but we've come to find that Cameron and I are different in
very
almost
different.
Any category you want to point out. Our gut reaction to things is always the opposite reaction. Our first reaction to opinions is usually opposite. Our preferences, even when it comes to food and other things.
It is very funny to watch.
Yeah.
As a third party.
Yeah. My mind is going through all the times we've probably said something and introduced something in a staff meeting, and Cameron's going, "Sounds awesome." And you're going, "That's ridiculous." Like at the same time.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Well, this actually sets up our episode really well for today. Usually we have a really wonky transition, but this is not one of them. We're in a series right now focused on cultivating a healthy church culture. And big picture, every church has a culture, and while some churches are healthier than others, many, unfortunately, do not have a healthy church culture. So we've been borrowing from Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger, and we've been using this metaphor of a fruit tree to help us out, kind of talking through these three subcultures, if you will. Branches that bear fruit, a trunk that supports and then feeds the branches, and then the roots that suck up nutrients from the soil. And we've been saying that last one is really the most important one, because if the soil isn't healthy, the tree won't be able to produce healthy fruit at all. So over the last few episodes, we've discussed several toxins in the soil of the American church that are inhibiting kingdom fruit. And of course, you can go back and listen to these if you want, but we talked about having a personality-driven church or celebrityism. We talked about the belief that growth is the mark of success, sort of growthism. And then in our last episode, we talked about the misuse and abuse of power or authoritarianism. And so today we want to name our fourth and final toxin, not that there aren't others, but this is the last one we're going to be talking about, and it's dogmatism. And I anticipate that both of you may have a little bit to say about this one, but let me just sort of set the stage by explaining what we're referring to when we use this term. So by dogmatism, what we're talking about is the policing and enforcing of quote-unquote right beliefs, and by extension then, quote-unquote, right behaviors. And I might add the adjective authoritarian to this label, authoritarian dogmatism, because this is fundamentally an extension of the misuse and abuse of power, which we talked about in our last episode. There's a power dynamic at play oftentimes with dogmatism. David Fitch, a friend and pastor of mine, said, "Fundamentalist authoritarianism misuses power to enforce belief." That's what we're talking about. So in this context, when you hear the word authoritarian, don't just think like something super extreme like North Korea or some crazy dictator. What we're getting at with the adjective authoritarian is this is how power is being used. Power is being used and abused to police and enforce right beliefs and by extension, right behaviors. Is making sense, guys?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and what we want to submit today is that this is a sign of an unhealthy church culture. And ironically, dogmatism is not just a sign of toxicity, but also a sign of fragility. Those who use power to enforce their beliefs by doing so betray their fear that their beliefs aren't able to stand up on their own apart from exerting pressure to conform. So dogmatism is a sign of an unhealthy church culture marred by toxicity and fragility. So here's the deal. I imagine you two have a fair amount to say about this, just knowing the two of you and all of that. So let me just turn it over to you guys. How have you experienced and noticed this in your life?
Can I share a story?
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Story time.
This is a story that involves my dad, who many of you guys know.
Because does he listen to this podcast?
Yeah, he does.
Okay.
He does, yeah. So I asked his permission to share it. I had this memory as I was preparing for this episode of being probably 8 or 9, somewhere in there. And I was a really curious kid, so I was always asking questions, and my dad and I would talk about life and things. And I remember asking him one day, "Hey, Dad, is there a chance that the Bible isn't real, isn't true?"
Mm.
And my dad, having been a philosophy major in college, responded something along the lines of like, Well, Katie, technically, we can't really know anything is true for certain. Like, how do you know Abraham Lincoln was really the president? And so he goes into this whole, like, this philosophical way of thinking about this, right? But mm-hmm. then, but he was also able to kind of talk to him about, like, well, let's believe why. He said, I believe it's true and I have the strongest possible belief, but let's talk about why I believe that and whatever. My 8-year-old brain then took that, and I remember being at Awana, like, I don't know, probably a week or two later, and telling my Awana, for those of you who don't know, Awana was the children's ministry, like a midweek children's group that met mm-hmm. here at the church. And oh, yeah. I remember telling my Awana teacher, my dad said there's a chance the Bible isn't true.
Oh, no.
And I was met with this face of, like, shock and awe, and I was told my dad is wrong. And I was not to ask that question again.
Mm.
So that to me is just a story that comes to mind when I think of, like, what is dogmatism to me? It's kind of this idea of these are our beliefs and it's unquestionable. Mm-hmm. Like, don't even ask the question. Mm-hmm. And okay, caveat, I was young and obviously, like, beliefs do need to be, like, simplified and you can't yep. have, like, a full nuanced conversation with an 8-year-old. So get that. But I do think there's something to be said about, like, my dad's posture. Hey, mm-hmm. let's talk about that. Like, mm-hmm. that's a good, actually, lots of people ask that question, is the Bible true? So let's talk about why they might ask that question and why we do believe it to be true. Like, there's a difference between that posture and the posture of essentially saying, like, if you even ask that question, like, your salvation could be at risk. Right?
Yeah, right. So maybe one of the signs, if we go, how do you detect dogmatism? You can't ask questions related to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also think it's funny just knowing your dad.
That's
pretty great.
My dad thinks.
this is, these are the waters I swam in growing up. I was raised in this type of environment where having the right beliefs, not just the right beliefs, but also the right opinions about a variety of issues is what it meant to be a Christian. And discipleship was essentially making sure that all of those beliefs and opinions lined up. I will say it as a quick caveat that I don't believe that any of this dogmatism was meant to be malicious, at least in the environment I was in. I don't believe that there was that a lot was being leveraged for personal gain. This is just what discipleship was. It wasn't just my church, it was also others. In this context, that this is what it meant to disciple people, was to shape beliefs and opinions and behaviors. And people who didn't line up with that or had opinions that were opposed to those were a threat. Mm. And were seen just as such. So, what you were saying, there was no freedom to ask questions. There wasn't a lot of freedom to express doubts.
People who thought differently, I just heard you say, were considered threats.
Yeah, very much so. There was no freedom to have your own opinion on biblical matters whatsoever, no matter how important or not important they were. There was no freedom to have your own political opinions, or to disagree with the pastor about much at all. I think all of this...
Who happened to be your dad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. essentially, and I think all of this was fueled by an anxiety that if people were to believe differently or behave differently than the predetermined set of rules, that they were essentially backsliding or falling away. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe this will transition, Mac, into what's wrong with this is mm-hmm. the fact that there is no room to differ on things that should be able to be differed upon. And when that's true, now when there's a crack in, if I choose to not believe this thing about what, you know, this church believes, pretty soon everything crumbles rather than building a foundation on the more solid parts.
Yeah, so to maybe take what both of you have said and put it together, dogmatism, you can sort of detect dogmatism when this quote-unquote Christian worldview, you didn't use that term, but I remember that kind of being a thing in certain mm-hmm. environments I've been a part of, but there's like this worldview this worldview consists of all of these right beliefs. This is what we think on A, B, C, and D. There's no margin for disagreement. There's no room for dialogue. This is what we think and believe. By extension, this is how we behave. And any questions about that are sort of shut down. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, is the Bible really true? We shut it down. There's no room to tend to nuance or to engage tension around those things. We don't consider other perspectives. People who think differently are treated as threats. So there's kind of this mm-hmm. us versus them dynamic. They're the enemy. They're backsliding. There's even a narrative maybe attached to mm-hmm. those people mm-hmm. who think differently or have changed their view from what we believe to now something different. Right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this creates then a culture where people are sort of forced to conform or they're excommunicated in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're given labels, any number of labels.
You know,
if the church was that, this other church or this other leader was differed on this opinion or doctrine, mm-hmm. that you would label them, put them in a camp as other, and now they are a threat to our belief system.
Yeah, and Josiah, you even said something that oftentimes the pastor is the one who gets to determine what those are, which then again connects to the conversation we had last time around this isn't just a neutral person. This is someone who's mm-hmm. invested with a certain degree of power or authority. You're not allowed to question. He's the one who's educated. He's the one who hears from God. He's the one who does this or that. And so there's a power dynamic and a spiritual dynamic at play oftentimes as well. Mm-hmm. 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 Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's get into, you know, what's wrong with this? Because maybe some of our listeners are sitting there saying, well, that's what I grew up with, and I don't really see a problem with that. Like, so let's fill that in for them, and I can get us started. You know, one thing I would share, because I've seen this happen so many times and witnessed it in so many people's lives, is that dogmatism leads to deconstruction. Dogmatism leads to deconstruction. One of the byproducts of authoritarian dogmatism is the widespread deconstruction we're seeing happening across our country, particularly with young people and their faith. I realize that deconstruction is sort of a buzzword and people are using it in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know what associations our listeners might have with that word, but let me provide a definition. Deconstruction is the process of dissecting an idea, belief, practice, tradition, or system to determine its truthfulness, usefulness, and impact, okay? So at its heart, deconstruction is a process. It's not a single event. It involves then the dissecting, a deep interrogation of a variety of things, ideas, beliefs, practices, traditions, and systems with the goal of reevaluating their merit, mm-hmm. right? The truthfulness, usefulness, or impact of those things. So here's what I'm noticing, okay? People who grew up in churches or faith traditions characterized by dogmatism, what you guys just described, where they were kind of told what to believe or how to behave, often in a very black and white way, where complex issues were reduced down to an unhelpful simplicity. What happens is people who grew up in this kind of environment eventually wake up to this. There's this moment where they begin to examine and interrogate the categories and the frameworks, the answers and the explanations, the beliefs and behaviors that they were given. And especially those who grew up in dogmatic faith communities, they inevitably discover that matters of faith simply aren't so black and white, right? That sincere and genuine people think and believe differently than what they were told. And these issues are often, they realize, way more complex than they were told. And now all of a sudden they're sitting in this mess of going, it's not as simple as what I was told. And this destroys trust. Mm-hmm. People often feel betrayed, like you lied to me. You didn't tell me the full truth. You misled me. You didn't give me all the options, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then here's what happens. One of two things usually happens, and I'm oversimplifying here, but just to name the pattern, there's sort of this leads to two trajectories. One is a process of deconstruction where the unhelpful things get discarded and a faith is reconstructed that is much stronger and more durable, usually one that's centered on Jesus. So one trajectory is deconstruction leads to a stronger faith. However, the other one is that this process of deconstruction actually leads to deconversion. Mm-hmm. People walk away from the faith, walk away from Jesus, and walk away from the church altogether. And I think we're seeing that on a
on a widespread, we're seeing that widespread right now. People who grew up in sort of dogmatic environments where they were told everything, here's how you believe it, have this wake up where they realize, oh, no, it's way more complex than that. And honestly, without proper engagement, walking alongside people, accompanying them through that deconstruction, they go to deconversion. Mm-hmm. You guys noticing this too?
Mm. Yeah.
What does that shake loose for you as I kind of...
Well, Josiah, I feel like you and I have both done a fair amount of deconstruction of certain elements of the faith that we grew up with. And I could name any number of topics. I mean, take gender roles, for example. I was taught that men are God ordained to be preaching and teaching and have authority in all these sorts of ways, and women were not to be teaching. And that was just a belief that we were supposed to take and say the Bible's, that's what the Bible says, so end of story. And for me, deconstructing that was a process of going, well, is that really what it says? And what does it mean? And wait a second, how did Jesus empower women? And that to me led to a what I believe is a more faithful interpretation, like a more filled out, comprehensive understanding of what Jesus actually did and said. And I guess a strengthened faith in a lot of ways. So that deconstruction was helpful to me, but it's work I had to do much later in life.
Yeah. Yeah. It, as you were talking, Mac, it made me think about the fact that dogmatism is sort of predicated on this notion, which is a lie, that I can actually control what other people believe. So if I have a healthy open-handedness about teaching and even like raising kids, I mean, I have kids, like I do reflect on, I want them to believe about things a certain way. But if I believe that I can control what they think and believe, then I'm going to do everything I can to shape and mold. And then what happens? They go off to college.
Yep.
And they're like, wait a minute, that's actually not what I believed all along. I mean, I think of people I grew up with that their parents would have thought they were, you know,
all together,
like cookie cutter, everything's good. They're in church, they're doing this, they go to youth group, they all these things. Then they send them out. And then, but I mean, I knew they didn't believe it any more than someone outside the church.
Yeah.
So there's this, I don't know. There's this fallacy that we think, especially as church leaders, that I can control what people think and feel.
That's right. Yeah, and maybe to just take this one step further, it would seem to me that how your faith environment even responds to someone deconstructing might be an indicator of how much dogmatism is at play, right? Mm-hmm. Because in many communities that are marked by authoritarian dogmatism, deconstruction isn't allowed. And so the moment people start asking questions that are off limits, they kind of get excommunicated. And then that's when they continue along that path and deconvert, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've walked alongside you, both of you, as you've asked a lot of questions that before maybe felt off limits. Mm-hmm. And with the goal of reconstructing a faith that is more Jesus-centered. And part of that is because my conviction is that we actually, even though deconstruction is sort of a buzzword, if we look at things through a biblical lens, like look at the story of Scripture, man, you see people doing this all the time, sort of holding up beliefs or values or practices, dissecting them for their merit and either strengthening it or getting rid of it. I mean, this is what the Old Testament prophets did. Mm-hmm. That's what they were doing. This is what Jesus did. This is what Paul did. And we have examples of this throughout church history, whether it's the Desert Fathers or, you know, the Protestant reformers, the Anabaptists, quite frankly, are a group that have done this really well, even the Great Awakening. So I'm saying within a when dogmatism is at play, deconstruction is a threat. Mm-hmm. When you're in an environment that's different than that, and we'll get to what that looks like, deconstruction is actually something you accompany someone through while pointing to Jesus. And by the way, we have a couple blogs on this. So if someone wanted to go deeper into how do you actually do that, I wrote a couple posts on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just share. I have a friend who's going through that exact same thing right now. Well, she is through it. We went to Haiti together in 2012 after the hurricane. That was a big turning point in her faith journey. She was really excited about growing in her relationship with God. Ended up in what I would say was a very dogmatic church, stayed there for about 10 years. And then a couple of years ago, started asking some questions. And the questions were met with being shut down. She was given, are you guys familiar with like the Pascal's Wager?
Yes.
Like Blaise Pascal, yes. Basically. If you, okay, he said to her,
if you're wrong,
if you don't believe in God and you're wrong, like you could go to hell.
Like
your salvation is at stake. But if you believe in God and you're right, well then look, basically the benefits of believing outweigh the risks. So it's rational to believe in God. So don't ask the questions, like just, and that's in my opinion, a terrible response to someone's questions. And she just felt so shut down.
Well,
and
Blaise Pascal disagrees with you.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he does. But she ended up walking away. It's sad because she just was like, okay, if there's no good answers and I'm going to be just have guilt and shame and fear leveraged at me for asking questions, then I don't want to be a part of this because it doesn't feel honest.
Yeah.
And she has no interest in even really having the dialogue anymore. And I think that she's like, I think it's really common. I think what happened to her is happening all over the place right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one I might add. So Mac, you talked about how dogmatism leads to deconstruction. Another one I would add is that I think dogmatism produces a fragile faith. So if we look at what faith is, maybe that's a good starting point to go like, okay, well, how do we think about faith? Some people might use the term like blind faith as this idea that it's just sort of like believing something and not giving much thought to whether it makes sense or whether it can be proven. Just know what you believe and like name it and claim it. But when we look at the Bible and how that it talks about faith, I think it's actually quite different from that. The term faith is more of a covenantal term, and covenant getting at the word like relationship. I think the whole story of the gospel revolves around God's covenant with his people. Like he makes certain promises and he's always good on his end of the bargain. And then the Bible's a story of how his people deliver on that mutual commitment, like on their end. And then the faith that we see in the story of God's people, Old Testament and New, are all about how they work through that, like how they wrestle with God. Mac, you taught me that the term Israel, like right, Israel was God's people, was actually connotes this idea of wrestling with God. Like Jacob, grandson of Abraham, spent a night wrestling with this mysterious figure, and then he comes out of it and God renames him Israel. As one who wrestles with God. And then his descendants have that name. And throughout the Old Testament, the people continue to wrestle with God. So to me, this idea of wrestling with God and asking questions and poking and prodding is like core to faith. And it's something that he not only allows us to do, I think God actually like honors it.
Yeah. You're naming something that I think is really important and significant and yet a total paradigm shift. I would imagine for some people, you're saying that actually wrestling with God and doubts and questions and struggles and so on is actually an expression of and central to faith.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in a lot of faith circles, faith isn't understood that way. Faith is sort of equated with certainty. Mm-hmm. The stronger my faith, the more certain I am, right? And one author I know uses the example of if you're at like a state fair and you know those like hammer or mallets that you use to like hit the thing and then the puck goes up to see how strong you are.
Whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
Not whack-a-mole. The strength thing.
Yeah, it's like the strength thing. And it's like it's almost like, hey, the stronger your faith is, the more certain you are, the stronger that hammer comes down and then the puck goes to the top. And so there's this direct correlation between certainty and the strength of your faith. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how a lot of people conceive of it, is that your faith is all about certainty. And this shift to go, oh, no, faith is ultimately a covenantal and relational term. And it's about walking with God despite the uncertainty, despite the doubts, despite the questions, right? Is just a different framework altogether. And see, if faith is equated with intellectual certainty, then any question, obviously, or any other viewpoint, obviously, is going to be perceived as a threat.
Yeah.
And yet, I think people of a mature faith aren't threatened by questions. They're actually able to sit in the tension of people's questionings. They're not sitting there all fragile and anxious about what if I have it wrong or whatever, because they're after truth. And you know, then if I don't have it right, then it's on me to wrestle with that and only get closer to it by asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
Making sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the byproducts of the fragility that this produces in our faith is. When the faith and belief system is handed to you and dictated to you, and you haven't taken the time to wrestle with what you actually believe about it, when it's challenged, it's not only a threat to the person who is trying to like make sure other people are believing something, but even you personally, when it's challenged now, what answer do I have? Mm-hmm. I don't have answers, nor do I have any tools that would help me sit in a conversation with someone who believes different. It doesn't help me to hear what they're saying, everything they're saying. If I don't have an answer to it, now I'm flustered and I'm angry, and this person's like attacking me. Mm-hmm. When in reality, this person just believes something different. And sometimes these could even be other Christians, people that are following Jesus.
Yeah,
that are seen as, I'm not equipped to handle being in relationship with anyone.
Yep.
Who feels or thinks differently than me.
Let me maybe give an example that shows the difference between like fragility and maybe the depth of faith that can come out on the other side, being willing to wrestle or entertain questions. One of the big turning points for me early on in my faith journey was about the resurrection. I had this crisis of belief around the historicity of the resurrection and whether I could actually believe that that happened. Now, if I have a fragile faith in a dogmatic community, I know the right belief is that Jesus was raised bodily from the dead, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's just like, okay, push away any question, any theory that would challenge that. Don't ask questions about it. Just try to maintain my intellectual certainty, right? Which then makes me very fragile, because anyone who maybe doesn't believe that, I perceive as a threat. Anybody who has a question about it or a theory as to something different, I have to like kind of keep at arm's length. What ended up happening to me is I decided to face it head on and studied a lot about it, including lots of theories from people who have alternative explanations than a bodily resurrection, okay? Mm-hmm. Which is uncomfortable. I'm going to name you. This is uncomfortable work, but that's part of the expression of faith. I'm trusting that God is going to lead me into the truth and hold on to me mm-hmm. as I work through this. Mm-hmm. Well, in the end, I affirm the historicity of Jesus's bodily resurrection. I now have tons more reasons for believing that than I did at the start. And I have counter explanations for those who have alternative theories to explain it away. Mm-hmm. My faith is much stronger, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But it required me to entertain ideas, questions, tensions that at first felt very scary. Mm-hmm. And I've repeated that pattern with dozens of topics and issues over and over and over again. And generally, I find that that's true.
Yeah.
That in the end, I walk away strengthened in my faith, maybe not always with the exact same belief that I started with. Usually it's a lot more nuanced, right? Mm-hmm. But you kind of get what I'm after.
Yeah. And look, as Christians, we believe God is truth, right? Like all truth stems from God. So what I love about that story is that any honest search for truth should end in knowing the truth about God.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's just something to say, hey, we can trust, we don't have to be fearful or anxious or scared. Like we can trust that God will make himself known mm-hmm. through mm-hmm. any honest search for truth.
Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah.
I really do. And I think you saw that in
you believe
your
that
story.
Dogmatically.
Yeah.
What else would you guys name about just kind of the problems with dogmatic faith communities?
Yeah, I would name another one would be dogmatism hurts our witness as a church. I maybe alluded to this a little bit in what I said earlier, but most of the issues that we face today are not black and white. They're quite complex, multifaceted, and nuanced. Dogmatism not only prevents us from thinking through things critically, like we talked about, but it also prevents us from holding space with others who may not think exactly like us.
Yes.
Right? We hold tightly to things that we may be wrong about. And then we end up seen as ignorant. Maybe we will bury our heads in the sand in order to keep our opinions the same. Right? Christians in this environment are often afraid to expand their knowledge on a subject and refuse to receive any wisdom or knowledge from anyone who is seen as an outsider. And I just feel like like ignorance is not Christ-like. Hmm. Like choosing to be ignorant about something is not like Christ. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between being naive about something you don't know mm-hmm. and then purposefully ignoring any other influence about your beliefs and thoughts. Like we can learn and increase our wisdom and understanding, and we should, as people who follow Jesus, and we don't have to be threatened by things if truth is ultimately true, whether we believe about it or not.
Yeah, and what I hear you saying is that actually helps our witness as a faith community. Mm-hmm. You know, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking, I have a lot of relationships with people who don't follow Jesus. Some of them didn't grow up in church at all, you know, but many of them did, and many of them grew up in churches that were dogmatic, mm-hmm. kind of like we're describing in this episode. And at some point, they woke up to that. They felt like what they had been given was inadequate, and they deconverted, okay? So as I engage them in relationship, if I approach them by embodying dogmatism, similar to what they grew up with, what do you think is going to happen, mm-hmm. right? They're going to push me away. It's kind of a non-starter, right?
Yeah.
So instead, with each of these people, my primary posture, I try to embody openness and humility. You know, I ask questions. I get curious. I often validate their questions. When they express frustrations, I often validate those frustrations and how they were treated in the faith communities they grew up with. And honestly, typically, the response is they're very surprised because mm-hmm. they often know what I do for a living. They know I'm a pastor, so they're surprised to hear this from a Christian, let alone a pastor, validating their questions and frustrations. And then what this does is it opens up space. I've just created some cognitive dissonance for them between what they grew up with and what they're now experiencing. And the context is relationship, trust building. Mm-hmm. And so now there's kind of a different witness that's created. I can begin to engage those questions because I'm not threatened by them. Mm-hmm. We can begin to actually have some real conversations. And maybe, just maybe, it creates an opportunity over a period of time where they shift from deconstruction to reconstruction.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You become someone that they can actually talk to about it and bring their questions. The other thing I wanted to say on these lines is that this cripples us from holding relational space with people who think differently.
Yes.
Right. And I know you're kind of talking about that. We can't relate to anyone who doesn't align with every value and opinion that was given to me within this context. This environment did not equip me for relating to people outside the walls of the church. Non-believers were viewed through a very oppositional lens, like we talked about before. Everything's a threat to my belief system, which was an issue. But I think this also extends to like other Christians.
Yes.
And so after I graduated high school, I spent a year in Sydney at this leadership school at a big church there. And
that explains the subtle accent.
Yeah. No, I did not pick up an accent. I got made fun of for mine, though.
It'd be cool if you did.
No.
Did you watch Bluey?
I don't think that existed then.
Probably not.
It was in 2008.
You're too old.
But no, I just remember being exposed to a lot of new ideas, either from the school. I remember one professor purposefully poking the bear very early on from essentially giving all of these different views of eschatology and the end times and how and where they differ and where they came from and all those things. And then he was telling me his beliefs and they weren't the ones that I was raised with. And I was like, it was like, what is happening? It felt like, who are these guys? Is he even a Christian? You know, like you start having this, like this crisis internally, or just from other people and sort of physically, feeling physically threatened by new ideas. But I do want to share that there are some relationships that have been very instrumental in my life growing up in this environment. And that's my relationship with Cameron. I know we referenced Cameron. He was on earlier podcast episodes. Cameron is from Portland, raised in an environment that's quite different from small town Midwest living. And I remember there was a moment where he first moved here, we were sitting around a fire and we were discussing an issue. I can't even tell you the exact one. I mean, there was a few, but he shared an opinion that I would have disagreed with. And to be fair, his opinion was much more informed than mine. But I remember feeling this feeling of sort of like losing respect. So I thought he was one way, but he must not. I sort of lose this respect for someone that was becoming a friend. But as I've pressed into relationship with Cameron, we actually really don't disagree about things that much. The bigger issue was just he was coming from a different perspective, had thoughts on things, was willing to kind of hold his hands open on things. I'm like, yeah, this is how I feel, but I'm still pressing into this. And my relationship with him really helped me to sort of
bust out of your posture.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if I come to the same conclusion, the bottom line is that I was able to like think for myself and be able to settle into something where I can say, hey, this is actually what I believe about it. It's not just what was handed to me when I was young.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're talking about our witness as a church, and I guess just one final thing that comes to mind is there's a story in Acts where Paul is speaking to the Athenians, and he's talking about a shrine with an inscription that says, to an unknown God. And he starts the conversation by saying, hey, I saw this shrine with this inscription, to an unknown God. Let's talk about that. Like, let's talk about who God is. He didn't start by saying, you idiots, and like knock down their shrines and say, no, this is who God is. Like, rather, he got to know them as a people. He came to understand like their desires. And then he was able to contextualize the gospel by meeting them like where they were at with like language about what was important to them. And that was the way to kind of best share the love of Jesus with them. So when I think about our witness as a church, I see like, that's kind of the opposite of what we're talking about. Like hitting someone over the head going, don't believe that, believe this. It's simple, duh. And going, okay, here are the questions I think you have, or here's some of the desires or longings I'm seeing. Like let's talk about how God might meet those.
Yeah. I mean, to take that passage one step further, Paul actually affirms them and then quotes some of their poets, which means he had studied their stuff a little bit, enough to be able to quote it extemporaneously. So there is sort of that a different posture than sort of, and Paul had every reason in that moment to be sort of repulsed by the false gods around him, but you just don't see him pivoting out of that. So I think that's a great example, Katie. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. All right. So some people might be sitting here listening to this conversation and going, all right, you guys,
is this, Portland?
Yeah. Isn't part of being a Christian or having any set of belief, it requires conviction, right? It's okay to have convictions. It's actually essential to have convictions. So what are you guys saying? Are you saying that that's wrong? Are you saying that we just throw our beliefs out the window and we swing the pendulum to a place where it's all relative?
What is this, Portland?
Okay. So in Portland, someone might say, what's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me. And is that where we're going with this? And I think we would say, no, dogmatism on one end and relativism on the other end are not the only two options. It's more nuanced than that. So how would you guys fill that out? What would you say about that? If you can stop laughing.
Just see how many times you can throw it in.
All our Portland listeners are dropping like flies.
Right? Yeah. Totally. That was impressive, Katie, that you held it together. Way to go.
I'm pretty focused. Mm-hmm.
Josiah, kick us off. What would you say? How do we relate to our beliefs as a community?
Yeah, well, first, we just need to soften our certainty and embrace some humility. Dogmatism is driven by this false certainty of what's right and true, but even our most certain beliefs and our most firm positions are still our mere human interpretations of greater truths. And we have to be able to start there. That doesn't necessarily mean we can't have the conviction, but it does mean that I have to have some humility, that my interpretation and my conviction can only hold so much weight. And everything that I'm believing about God's truth is still filtered through my humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is hard. This can be hard for some people, but I agree. I think one key to softening our certainty is just to remember that none of us have sort of a completely objective understanding of reality. We all see the world through a set of frames, and those frames serve as filters, right, through which we see the world. So perhaps some illustrations or ways that getting at this might be helpful. There was a guy named Alfred Korbitsky. He's Polish, and he coined this phrase, the map is not the territory, all right? And what he was getting at was was that our understanding of the world isn't the same as the actual world, right? So if you're traveling somewhere and you've got a map out, that map isn't the same thing as the territory or the region you're traveling in. And he's saying, look, your mental models, right, are like the map, and reality is like the actual territory. Is that making sense? So he's going, don't confuse the two. The map is not the territory. And so we all have mental models through which we make sense of the world, but these mental models are not the same thing as reality itself. And when we confuse those two, man, our certainty goes through the roof and we're unaware that we're doing any interpreting at all, right? There was an artist that really helped me with this. His name is René Magritte, and he was a 20th century artist. Have you guys ever seen the movie The Thomas Crown Affairs? You guys ever seen that movie? Okay. Well, there's sort of a throwback or callback to him. He's the guy with like the top hat. There's like the scene at the end of the movie with all these top hats to kind of throw off things. And that was inspired by René Magritte. But he's got two paintings I want to mention that I think get at what I'm talking about that help soften our certainty. The first is this painting called The Human Condition. And if you're listening to this and buy a computer, go ahead and Google it. But the painting is basically, well, it's this. There's an easel placed inside of a room, but just in front of a window. Okay? And it's really interesting because on the easel is an unframed painting of the landscape that seems to be, in every detail, mapping what's outside the actual window. You guys following what I'm saying? And in fact, when I first saw the painting, I didn't even notice the easel at all. I just thought I was looking out the window. Okay? And what he's getting at is he's going, this is how reality works. Like your mental, your frame of reference is like the painting of the landscape outside, but it's not the same as the landscape outside. It's the painting. Does that make sense? The second one is called The Treachery of Images, and I've actually got this painting or a picture of this painting in my office, and it's a painting of a tobacco pipe, okay? And it's just a standard tobacco pipe, but underneath it, it says in French, René Magritte was French, this is not a pipe. And it sort of throws you for a loop because it makes you stop and I'm like, what? What do you mean it's not a pipe? Of course it's a pipe. Look at it. It's a pipe. But then you go, oh, you're right. It's not a pipe. It's a picture of a pipe. And that's a big difference. And that's how reality works. We have these mental models, these pictures of reality, but those aren't the same as reality itself, right?
Yeah.
Maybe to get at this by way of illustration, this happened just yesterday. Katie, I was actually on the phone with your mom, and she was telling me of a conversation she had to have with someone who was teaching something to one of her clients that was theologically problematic. And your mom is not afraid to kind of, she's not afraid of conflict, which I really appreciate about her. So she called this individual and just said, hey, this is what you're kind of telling my client. It's hurtful, harmful, destructive, and not accurate theology, right? This person got really defensive. And one of the things this person did, started shouting, got really dysregulated, was that I read the Bible every day. Every day. And it's like, yeah, I'm sure you do. But if you're reading the Bible through a specific set of lenses, you're going to keep interpreting it the exact same way. Right? The problem isn't that you're reading it every day. The problem is you need a new set of lenses.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is, and I've given a few options here, the map isn't the territory, kind of some work by René Magritte. What I'm saying is we have to be aware that our understanding of reality isn't the same as reality itself. And what that does is it immediately, if you really reckon with that, it produces humility, softens our certainty and produces humility.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really easy to convince ourselves that we can interpret not only scripture, but also other Orthodox Christian beliefs, that we can interpret them from an objective framework. Nobody can. All of us are being influenced by everything around us. And so if you don't realize that, I mean, even like just take any issue, for example, how you might feel about it is influenced by the people around you, the people you would call friends, the people you listen to, the podcasts you listen to, the books you read, the social media you consume. Like, all of this is informing and shaping your lens in what you're naming Mac, is that it's shaping the lens and creating the thing that we're interpreting even scripture itself through.
Yeah. And you can have convictions while acknowledging, and these are the lens I'm wearing.
Yeah.
Kind of going back to how your dad responded to you. Yeah. Some people don't believe in the Bible, and here's why. But here's why I do it, and here are the reasons for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not pretending that I have objective, like, the
perfect
only,
knowledge.
Yes. Yeah. But you're being honest. Here are my frames, and here's what shapes my convictions.
Yeah. Can I share a light bulb moment that I had recently that goes in line with this? So I grew up in, thanks for the permission.
Well, you asked.
What is this, Portland?
I grew up in evangelicalism. And there's a lot of good, there's a lot of good that we could talk about. I've seen how many people came to faith within, the evangelical world. But one light bulb moment I had recently is with the term historic Christianity. I remember that term being used a lot, like biblical worldview, historic Christianity within the faith culture I grew up in. And a couple of years ago, I was reading a book that helped me realize that even modern evangelicalism, as I experienced, is really only a couple hundred years old. Like, if that, right? Like, it just kind of came to fruition in like the 18th, more like 19th century. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about the certainty that everything within, I feel like I grew up in a culture that everything within this evangelical bubble, there was such certainty around it. Like, we had it all figured out. We had the corner on truth. And any other like faith, tradition, religion should all be viewed with suspicion. There was no admission that they have anything to offer. Well, when you all of a sudden sit back and you go, wait a second, if this thing is only like 200 years old, we're dismissing like 1800 years of church tradition and history since the time of Jesus, like maybe we shouldn't be so quick to discount everything in the name of, we have the corner on historic Christianity. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, in some sense, we just betray our historical ignorance because we don't understand how, take any topic, any theological issue. There's a long history of how the church has, through the centuries, interpreted that issue. And we just boil it down to, well, it's this. Mm-hmm. And we're unaware that that's actually a pretty new invention theologically. It just betrays our ignorance.
And so many issues, once I really did start to wrestle with other kind of theologians and beliefs, the thing that I thought was old belief, historic Christianity, was actually quite new. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned more about what was actually more faithful and original, in a sense, to who Jesus was. Mm-hmm. Like, this search for truth, this deconstruction, again, led to a more faithful understanding of sure. Christianity in a lot
yeah.
of sense.
All right. So, we've got to soften our certainty, and that sort of increases our humility. Another one I would share would be, we need to distinguish between majors and minors. And for any of our listeners that have been through our DNA class in the last, 5 years or so, they're probably familiar with this because I teach it kind of at the front end of the class to say, here's how we orient to belief as a church. And I didn't come up with this. I'm going to share it a little bit here. I learned this in my very first theology class in my undergrad. So this is kind of like theology 101 stuff. This is not high level, very basic stuff. But the basic conviction is that not all beliefs should be treated as equal. Mm-hmm. And so there's this, imagine sort of three concentric circles, almost like a target or a bullseye. At the very center are dogmas, and these are sort of the core tenets of the Christian faith that pretty much all Christians, no matter their denomination, they agree on, right? These are the central beliefs that are sort of salvific in nature. And there are things like, Jesus died on the cross and rose again, that Jesus was fully God and fully man, right? These things that, if you're going to consider yourself a Christian, you're going to buy into these things, right? And they're beliefs that all Christians throughout all the centuries have affirmed as true. A great reference point for this, I think, is just the Apostles' Creed, because it's continually been affirmed sort of as a creed or statement of faith throughout the centuries. So you've got your dogmas, and those are the most important beliefs, and those are at the center. Then the ring outside of that are doctrines. And these are a little bit different because these beliefs aren't salvific in value or nature. They're not going to determine whether you're saved or not. And Bible-believing, Jesus-following Christians disagree on some of these, right? And it's not whether or not they believe the Bible to be true. That's not the issue. The issue is, what do they believe the Bible is saying? It's their interpretation of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so examples of this, we could probably think of many, but like baptism would be one. You know, when I was in school, I had professors that belonged to churches that baptized infants and some who belonged to churches that only baptize adults. And both of them had scriptural arguments to support their position and their practice, mm-hmm. right? If you grew up in the church or have transitioned through denominations, you might notice people celebrate communion differently. Catholics believe in transubstantiation, Lutherans consubstantiation. For us, it's more of a symbolic thing, right? There's different viewpoints on that, and we could keep going. But oftentimes, these are sort of the denominational levels that affect how church life happens, their practices, official statements and beliefs that churches or denominations have to make that distinguish them from other churches. And so that's sort of the doctrine category. And there's a lot of other ones we could name. But then the final one is opinions, and our opinions are just that. They're differences of a theological opinion based, again, not on setting the scripture aside, but how we understand and apply it. Unlike doctrines, you're not going to organize your entire church around an opinion. Mm-hmm. At least you shouldn't. You're not going to create a denomination around it. That'd be really bad news. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of things that fall under this category. So in our denomination, like Calvinism versus Wesleyanism, that's just an opinion. They don't have like a doctrinal statement on what we have to believe on that. That's up to local churches or even diversity within local churches, right? A creationism, like what's your view on that? That's a theological opinion. You're not going to build an entire church around that belief. That would be kind of foolish. I'm sure some have done it, but like that's not what you're going to do, right? Extraterrestrial life, right? Like all this stuff. These are just, you can have your opinion on that, but it shouldn't rise to the level of like a dogma or a doctrine. All right. So the main point, what this does is just having that dogma, doctrine, opinion sort of framework, what it does is it allows us not to treat all beliefs as equal. And it allows us to major on the majors and then minor on the minors. Maybe you've heard this statement before that in essentials, we want unity. In non-essentials, we want liberty, freedom. And in all things, we want charity or love. And I think in dogmatic communities, in dogmatic circles, what ends up happening is all beliefs are treated as equal, mm-hmm. right? Kind of like you were sharing that, Josiah, about your story. Like, here's all the things you had to believe, including opinions, mm-hmm. right? And this framework, at least for me and in our church community, gives us a lot of flexibility to go, hey, we're unified on the things that matter most. We're not changing our conviction on those. Those have been vetted and true and so on and so forth. But man, if you hold a different position on me over here, that's okay. We can talk about it. Love to have a dialogue with you about it, but it doesn't have to like break us apart, mm-hmm. you know? So what I've noticed is that churches that and communities that don't have sort of that tier system of belief, they treat all beliefs as equal, right? What ends up happening is it creates this dynamic where if you're not with us, you know, then and all, check all these boxes. Well, again, we go back to kind of that threat thing, right? Mm-hmm. And in some cases, because you can't distinguish between salvific and non-salvific issues, like your faith is on the line. Mm. Your salvation is on the line. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have heard pastors speak of young earth versus old earth creationism. Believing in a literal 7-day creation is a salvific issue. Mm. And if you don't believe that, then everything crumbles. That would be an example of elevating a non-salvific issue to one that is. And again, this all comes back to this connection to a fragile faith that can lead to deconstruction or this sort of fear-mongering almost that gets laid out that if you do feel differently than that, well, you better not express it. And if you do... I think it just ends up creating this unnecessary separation between people. People who might want to be a part of a church community feel like they can't mm-hmm. because, you know, maybe even just like think of, we even talked about the whole like political spectrum of beliefs. that that you find in churches. Like many people feel like, oh, I love this community, but and these people here, but I don't feel like I can be a part of it because I might land in a different camp here.
That's right.
And so it ends up creating this unnecessary chasm between people that doesn't need to be there.
A great resource here that I'll mention is a book called Across the Spectrum. It's written by actually two of my professors I had, Greg Boyd and Paul Eddy. And what it does is it takes, I don't remember the exact number, maybe 15 or 16 sort of theological topics that evangelicals disagree on. And then within each chapter, it presents those different viewpoints where people disagree, how they defend that position from the scriptures, and then sort of weaknesses to that position. Mm. At no point do the authors tell you what you should believe. They don't settle it for you. But what I find is working through that resource with people, it just gives them an appreciation for things being more complex than they thought. And it actually increases their appreciation for understanding different viewpoints, even if it doesn't align with theirs.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. One final one I might name is we need to prioritize self-differentiation. This term might sound familiar. We talked about it quite a bit in our emotional maturity series. And how we generally define this idea of self-differentiation is, if I'm remembering correctly, staying relationally connected and self-defined at the same time. So throughout our conversation today, we've been talking about dogmatism in some ways as like a posture, right? Of someone feeling threatened and shooting down questions because there's no ability or freedom to disagree or to poke and prod. And I get this idea of self-differentiation, of an ability to hold tension with someone and go, yep, that's what you believe and this is what I believe, and kind of hold that space while remaining relationally connected, rather than one of the two extremes of we disagree, so therefore I'm cutting you off relationally. We can't talk about this anymore because you think one way and I think another, and so boom, conversation over. Or on the other end, getting kind of overly enmeshed and pretending like I agree with you and, oh, everything's great. Yeah, I totally agree. And getting overly connected, but losing definition. The ability to be self-defined and relationally connected is what we call self-differentiation. And that's a sign of maturity. And I think it's really necessary to be able to do this work that we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you just said, I think, is worth highlighting, that self-differentiation, if you go back to our EQ series, self-differentiation is a mark of maturity. Mm-hmm. Because I can be connected to you, but we can think differently. But if I have to have you think the exact same way as me, which is how we're sort of defining dogmatism, mm-hmm. that's not a sign of relational health or maturity. It's actually a sign of immaturity. So for those of our listeners who grew up in a highly dogmatic faith community, bad news, that's sort of an unhealthy, immature relational environment to be raised in. Mm-hmm. Whereas kind of going back to that example of your dad, it's actually much more healthy to kind of, at an age-appropriate level, totally get that, like name the different options and give people permission, which Josiah, you said, you can't control anyways.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you're basically validating reality. They have permission to explore and to think and to figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Think of saying like, that's interesting you would ask that, or that's interesting you might feel that way. Here's how I think, and why don't we talk about that, as opposed to, no, you're wrong.
Yeah, and it's hard work. I'll name it's hard work. When someone says something that I disagree with, or that we acknowledge disagreement in the realm of a conversation, I experience that as a threat. We experience disagreement oftentimes as a threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, it's a sign of maturity to not respond as if I'm threatened, when in fact there's no threat here. Mm-hmm. We're just having a conversation.
Yeah.
So.
All right, you guys, we've been talking a long time. Why don't we shift towards concluding our conversation with diving into just some practices. Like if someone's listening to this and going, okay, I hear what you're saying, how do I actually embody this? How do I practice it? What would you say?
Well, one thing I would say is to soften your certainty. And a way to do this is to use language that reminds yourself that you're just sharing your opinion or perspective on things. Mm-hmm. And this is something I've had to work on quite a bit, because I tend to speak sort of forcefully and with conviction. And oftentimes I'm honestly just trying ideas out. So I've had to explain that to the people around me. But I've also, over the years, learn to incorporate language that communicates to other people that I'm sort of not as certain as I may sound. So phrases, I just wrote a few down. This is just my opinion, but here it is, would be softening your certainty. I could be totally wrong about this, but I think A, B, C, or D. You're acknowledging. I'd be open to your thoughts on this. My thoughts right now are this. You're kind of communicating some intellectual flexibility there, right? I'm opening to hearing from you, and you could shape how I think about this. I'm still learning here, but right now, here's what I think. In other words, more learning, I still have more to learn. I'm still in process, but the way I see things right now is this. At this point in my journey, here's how I'm making sense of it. I wonder about this or that, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all these little phrases I've tried to incorporate, especially in contentious conversation where we're discussing, you know, big matters, mm-hmm. to sort of soften my certainty for myself and for other people so that, you know, more mutual dialogue can happen.
Another one I might add would be just get curious. You know, when you look at, when you read the New Testament, I look at how Jesus talked and dialogued, like he asked a ton of questions. And I think when we talk about dogmatism, it gives me this idea that we pretend like faith is simple and we have all the answers. And if you don't agree with us, well, you're just wrong. Like there's no curiosity about someone who thinks differently and what they might have to offer the conversation. So you have a theologian that comes from a different camp. Are we willing to hear that person out? Consider what they have to say. Honestly, wrestle with it. We talked about the term like wrestling with God. Or do we see it as a threat that shouldn't even be considered? Jesus got curious all the time, and I think we are to do the same.
Yeah, that reminds me that I think I've referenced this book on this podcast before, but Heather Holloman, she's a professor at Penn State, and she wrote this book called The Six Conversations, short little tiny book that spoke of her experience helping students connect with each other, and referenced how terrible they were at it, especially when there was a difference of opinion. Mm-hmm. And so she prides herself on being able to essentially hold conversation and hold relationship with anyone, no matter how different they may think. And mm-hmm. she is a Christian raised in a more probably an environment like ours. And she has a couple of these in the back of the book. She has all these conversation, not just conversation starters, but I've heard her say that she has these ways of keeping conversations going when someone brings an opinion that's opposed to hers. One of them is she just simply says, "Wow, it's clear you have a really strong belief about this subject. I'd love to hear the story behind your conviction."
Mm. Yeah.
And so that now instead of being
defensive.
And defensive, the other person gets a chance to not only share what they think, but hopefully share some of the story as to why. Maybe you find out that this is what my family's always believed, or this and this happened so far, so that means this. And she's just talked about how it pays off in being able to keep conversation open. And, you know, it just requires all these same, it just requires all the same things we've been talking about. This, if truth is going to be true, no matter what I think about it or someone else does, I don't have to be so afraid of hearing someone else's opinion.
Yeah.
I like that phrase too. Like, hey, you seem to have a conviction around that. Tell me the story of how that developed or whatever. Just because it gives us language for curiosity. I think, you know, I'm seeing a lot about like learning how to be curious and so on. But sometimes it helps to have those little phrases to even know what it sounds like, you know?
Totally.
To get curious. Like, yep. Katie, you seem to really like scrunchies. How did that affinity for scrunchies come about?
I'm curious. Let me tell you, I was born in the 80s.
Yeah, I like to use the term if someone says something rather than just pretending I agree with it or trying to have a reaction to it. Just like, oh, that's really interesting. I mean that. Clearly, like, I'm okay hearing more about it. I'm also not stating that I agree with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to have any sort of position within it.
As you said that, there's that movie, Meet the Fockers, where he's like, that's interesting, Greg. And it just shuts down the conversation.
That's funny. So a third practice I would name is take a topic and explore the various positions. Practice listening to opinions that you disagree with. I would say podcasts are the perfect place to start because there are thousands, if not millions of episodes that you could just pick a spot and point and listen to someone talk who has an opinion and hopefully one that's different than yours, and just practice sitting in that and notice how you feel in the moment and how your nervous system is responding. I remember going back to when I was in Sydney, and I would have some of these conversations with people around me that I was just this onslaught of doctrines and things that I was unaware that they even existed. I remember feeling physically threatened, like flushed, emotionally flooded, like something's happening to me, right? So like my body's thinking there's a threat of danger here. And notice that maybe even as you're listening to the podcast, you may actually be feeling that way. Notice those things and being exposed to that a little bit, reminding yourself, hey, I'm perfectly safe here. Their opinion does not change what truth is, and I can just listen. And I think that maybe would help increase our capacity to handle sitting in relationship with people who believe different.
Yeah. And let's say if you're listening to this and you grab that book Across the Spectrum and you just take one of those topics and read the chapter and look up the verses that people use to support their different positions. And at the end of each chapter, they have like 8 academic books on like to go deeper. If you genuinely went after that, your conviction may not change. Like you may still come out the same way on that particular topic as you started, but I guarantee you your posture will change along the way. You won't be as certain as you were before. Like it will soften the edges that you'll have a more informed conviction, but you'll be able to hold that conviction differently in a less dogmatic way.
Yeah.
So guys, big picture, we named a final sort of toxin that, sort of corrupts the soil of the American church. And that's just dogmatism, sort of policing right belief and right behavior rather than having a more robust faith that can actually tolerate differences of opinion, exploration, and even this necessary process of deconstruction to reconstruct a faith that's more centered on Jesus.
Well, thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Next time, we're going to be shifting gears, and we're actually going to begin discussing some of the positive nutrients that we can put into the soil to help create a healthy church culture. We hope you will continue to tune in.
Praxis is recorded and produced at Crosspoint Community Church. You can find out more about the show and our church at crosspointwi.com. If you have any questions, comments, or have any suggestions for future topics, feel free to send us an email. Also, if you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.